Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday morning. It is the 20th of August, 12 minutes past 9 o'clock, and an absolute pleasure to be in your company this morning. We love when we get together and we can talk about what's going on, and that's exactly what we're going to do this morning. We have a wonderful panel to do it with, and I will introduce them to you in just a moment. Before I do that, I want to welcome you not only to the show, but to the proceedings that you please can write us a note, email us, and we'd love to hear from you on the wide range of topics that we're going to discuss over the next 100 minutes or so. So please, anything on your mind, let us know, panel@wamc.org. We do ask, you know, that you keep it on point and short and to the point and use verbs and all that kind of stuff. We welcome you, though, panel@wamc.org. Let me introduce the group to you, or introduce, as we say in the States. WAMC's Alan Chartek is here. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Yes, indeed. That's exactly what we say in the States.
Yes. We say good morning. That's what we
good
say.
Good morning.
Good morning, and welcome. Also, we have Terry Gibson on the line. He is SUNY New Paltz communications professor, former New York State senator. Terry Gibson, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. There's other things that we say in the States, but I don't think I can say them on the radio.
No,
so I'll
please.
Just say good morning.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. Keep it fresh. Berkshire Eagle reporter Jen Smith joins us. Good morning, Jen. How are you? Paging Jen Smith.
I have a feeling something went wrong.
Yeah.
Good morning. Good morning.
There you are. As if, it's so weird because without having people in the room, you just wait to hear the voice from the heavens. And I've said you were heaven sent many times, Jen, but here we go.
I'm a late star. What can I say? But I'm here this morning.
It's wonderful to have you on the program as always. And Linda Ellerbe is here, a Peabody and Emmy Award winning journalist. Our dear friend, good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. It's a gorgeous morning.
It is. It's a very pretty late August morning. A little bit of chill in the air. It tells you what's coming, and it's just beautiful and lovely. And I'm thrilled that we're all together and that we're talking to each other and with each other as all on a beautiful day. And we'll try to make this as upbeat as we possibly can. It's difficult. But we'll do our best. Let us start. Again, we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll begin with the Democratic National Convention. Many speeches last night, but history was made. Kamala Harris made history as first woman of color to accept a major party nomination for vice president. She wrapped up the third night of the convention with a speech that she gave in Delaware, and it was weird to see her in a big hall with just a few reporters scattered throughout, but it was a powerful speech. It was a very biographical speech, and it came, and I wouldn't think that anyone would want to follow President Obama, especially with the beautiful speech that he gave last night. But Kamala Harris did a gorgeous job, and it was really a meaningful and thoughtful, I think, introduction for many people to her and to her family, and was certainly well received by those, and I know we've said this over the last two or three days in covering it, of those who are actually watching the convention, which we know the numbers are down, but we also, everything's down because it's weird and we're living through a pandemic. So, Alan, let us begin with you.
Well, what's left to say? What you just said is right on the money, Joe. You know, her speech was terrific, and she is, I know people are going to object to this, but she really has style. She has the ability to attract a lot of people not only to her words, but the way she presents her words. She is, at least thus far, an ideal candidate. And your mention of Obama was exactly right. He gave a thoughtful Obama-like speech. I saw one journalist refer to it as emotional. It wasn't emotional. It was a very good speech. And it was traditional Obama ability to get inside of a difficult subject. He had some things to say which I thought were great, including the fact that Trump won't change because he can't. He can't. And that little insight said a lot about mental health of the president and everything else. So I thought it was a terrific speech.
I agree. And it was he had anger. He had rage at some points. And he when talking about the civil rights movement, I think, yeah, maybe not emotional, but certainly came from, I think, was as open as he's ever been on that subject and his place in history as a result of that movement, which I thought was beautiful. Linda.
Well, I've listened to both men discuss this, and what I heard was that Kamala was wonderful because she was soft and personable and lovely, and Obama was wonderful because he showed rage. I'm going to tell you that my opinion of Kamala's speech was that it was an historic speech, without question. The fact of it was historic. The speech was not historic. Part of that was the way television set it up. But for me, sitting and watching, if I could have a moment here, in 1984, Andrea Mitchell and I were in a car driving in San Francisco. We were there producing a show about the convention, but not covering it on a daily basis at that moment, when Geraldine Ferraro's candidacy was announced. And I was driving the car. I pulled over to the side of the road, and Andrea and I sat there and we cried. We sobbed in front of no one but ourselves at such an historic moment, and that we were finally seeing someone who looked like us. And then the coverage of the woman began, and it was as sexist as coverage could be. It was, why did she use her maiden name? Or how is she going to take care of her children and do this? Or, how did she? It was everything, but it was, can you bake cookies, as was asked of Hillary. Last night, what I saw, first of all, the evening, I loved the evening, and I'll come back to that. But what I saw in Kamala's speech was, again, this feeling that women somehow have to portray themselves as, aren't they also really good family people? Aren't they also really women? Aren't they also girls? Don't they look lovely? Don't they look calm? They're not shrieking. They're not angry. They're being personable. There was nothing wrong with anger last night, and many other people showed it. I thought that the setup was terrible for Kamala. The empty auditorium, the flags, all of the other speeches were intimate, one-to-one. You were talking. Now, I understand they were trying to make it look presidential. It didn't. It looked stilted. That empty auditorium was a terrible way, putting her at a podium instead of letting her talk to you eye-to-eye. I know they're doing it to build her up, but it did not serve her purposes. And I guess I'm just asking the question of, when can we simply behave the way politicians behave and male politicians behave without having to say, well, yes, I'm on the Supreme Court, but of course I'm home in time to cook dinner.
So whose fault do you think that was?
Good question, Joe.
Well, I think it may have been good politics. They're trying to behave, appeal to the broadest, but I would ask, the same question you're asking is, why are we still doing this? Why are we still expecting something a little different from the women than the men? We don't ask men, can you bake cookies? We don't ask men, be sure you show us, show us that you can how to behave with the grown-ups, with the men, with the power people. We have broken a lot of ceilings, and even Nancy Pelosi, you know, I was talking about breaking the marble ceiling. We are still trying to break the male ceiling in politics, and we need more women to help us do that. But last night was a celebration of women, and a very smart one by the Democrats the whole way. I can talk more about that later, but that was my feeling about this speech.
By the way, was that...
I was disappointed.
Was that Summer Sunday, the show that you did with Andrea Mitchell?
Yes, it was.
Now, you had
a dreadful show.
You had a truck, right? You had a van.
That was the whole purpose of the truck. NBC had a truck that suddenly, it was a portable truck, which meant for the very first time, now this is way back in 86, that we could, it was a satellite truck. We could link, uplink, and then downlink from anywhere in the country. So they decided to do a show that traveled all summer and aired on Sunday from anywhere in the country. And the whole point was, look what we can do. But unfortunately, the truck didn't work very well, and the show was withered by horrible, horrible technical mistakes. And it ended up being an embarrassment to be on, to be part of.
Jen Smith, what do you make of what happened last night?
Yeah, you know, I say this often, but, you know, convention speeches to me are a bit of, you can only do, I completely agree with Linda saying that the setup was terrible. And I listen to speeches, but I like to go back and read the transcripts. And she just, Senator, you know, our vice presidential had to pack to time that she had. And, you know, I guess I'm wondering what is effective when doing this speech, and what are we hoping for from a speech like that, especially because we just saw her, you know, there wasn't much time between her first speech as the vice presidential nominee and, you know, and this one. And so she was echoing a lot of the same things. So, you know, I'm still digesting it. I'm more so looking forward to what comes next and what she does about saying, you know, who she is as a vice presidential candidate and what she says about, you know, being part of this proposed administration.
Yeah, but weren't you impressed, Jen, by her, by the delivery of the speech and the quality of what was in it? I know I was.
I mean, yeah, I think there are other speeches and interviews of hers that I've appreciated more than this one. But, you know, I liked the beginning of the speech where she did call out on the people and the women, especially, who did the hard work, and that it focused on that hard work to lay the trail for her to get there. To me, that was very inspiring because we don't talk about that history very much in schools or in the media. So I liked that that got a national platform. But, you know, I don't think I was overly surprised or wowed by everything. She spoke a lot about in the second part of the speech about, like, why we should vote for Joe, which is what she was supposed to do in that moment, because he is the one running for president. But, you know, that's if you want me to sum up my reception in one word, I'm like, okay, you know, it was nice to see, but I'm looking forward to more.
Terry Gibson.
Me too. Yeah. I'm with Jen on that.
Terry.
Yes. You know, one of the courses I teach is public speaking. And last night I was reminded of the struggle that we have in this class that I teach, which I'm doing online right now, of trying to figure out how do you communicate with an audience that isn't actually there, that you can't actually see. And I see them struggling with the same thing as they try to figure out how to present speakers to the public. I do think it was a mistake to try to place our vice presidential nominee in an auditorium with no audience and to kind of pretend that they were there. I think the most effective speakers we're seeing so far are those that speak directly to the camera. The camera zooms right in on them. And it's an opportunity, really, that conventions don't usually offer, to look directly into the candidate's eyes and begin to really see who they are, because it's very hard to hide when that camera is right in your face. And I think that her speech would have been better had they framed it in that fashion. I do, however, still think it was a very strong speech. I thought it was the strongest speech of the night, and I think she's a much more powerful speaker than Joe Biden, and I think she rivals President Obama in her speaking ability. So I'm looking forward to more from her, and I think she'll only improve and grow, as all candidates do, as she moves forward. I did want to just mention one thing I noticed that President Obama did say in his speech that I haven't heard a lot of talk about. Is he actually called out, he made a call to action for voters to vote for Democrats up and down the ballot. Mm. And one of the mistakes that the Democratic Party has made in the past decades is not putting enough emphasis on helping the entire ballot get elected. And it's one of the reasons they've been left with such a short bench often. It's a void that Bernie Sanders was able to step in and kind of help fill. I was really glad to see him do that, and I hope that they will continue to advocate for not just voting for president, but voting for all Democrats up and down the ballot.
When, Alan, did you want to say anything else?
No, I think there's a caution here that I want to give to everybody, although I don't think it will be well received. And that is, these folks have their primary goal as winning an election. They got to win. So they're going to do some things that, you know, people may not like. Kamala Harris puts her arm around her husband while he's standing there with him in a very obvious way. Very smart, very smart. Now, there will be people who say, no, that wasn't necessary. She's a strong woman. She stands on her own. Look, this is a country filled with prejudices, and if they're not harmful and you can harness them, I think you do it. And implicit in a lot of the critiques that are going to be going on about her and about what she does is going to be, they shouldn't have done that. But I think the name of the game here, more than anything else, is to win and to get rid of this guy who is sitting there, this imposter, sitting in the White House. So you'll have to forgive them for listening to their pollsters and listening to their handlers and doing those things.
Yeah.
May I speak directly to you, Alan?
We have 1 minute, but yes, go ahead.
You're right. They have to play those games. I don't think there's anyone who objects to seeing her hug her husband. I think that's taking it to an illogical conclusion. But you're right, and as women, we understand the games that we have had to play. I thought the evening was well served, and like you, the point of the thing is to take down Trump. I wanted to ask you a question because I'm not sure how I feel about this, and Rolf and I talked a lot about it last night after the event was over. It was only during the immigration segment that they showed clips of Trump and used his own words against them. They're animals. We don't want them here. I wondered why in the gun segment, in the various segments, that they did not do the same. And Rolf said, well, you know, it's because we're trying to look positive, not negative. And my thought was maybe a little more of that might have helped, because
we do
our
have
major
to,
point is to take down Trump. And nothing works for that better than his own words.
Agreed. We're going to take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk about this right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Jen Smith, Terry Gibson, and Linda Ellerbe. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan, of course, tonight will be the night that Joe Biden will give his speech, and he will, the final night of the convention. What do you think we can expect from tonight, and what should we expect?
Well, I know what we should expect. We should not expect Joe Biden to pretend what he is not. I think a lot of people love Joe Biden and voted for Joe Biden because he represents a symbol of the ability to get along and get rid of this president. And that's why they voted for him. But if they're saying, if he overreacts to Sleepy Joe and starts to try to create an image of himself, which is phony, that would be a big mistake, in my opinion. I think he has to make the case, and I think he also has something else to do, and that is to say exactly what he wants to get done when he's president, or a good deal of it, because that's going to be a reason for people to vote for him. When it comes to the health care of their children, for example, that's going to be very important. And you can go on down the line doing those things. They have to be reassured that he's going to be stable, that he's going to bring some equanimity to the whole thing, if that's the right word, probably not. And that they can also like him and relate to him. And he doesn't want to screw that up.
Linda?
I can't add to what Alan said. I agree with him completely. Joe is in the place of to what tonight has to be about is, Joe, don't screw it up.
Right. But we know he has that pension, so you just hold your breath, right?
Well, he's not going to be freewheeling here. He's not going to he's not going to be doing faux pas because he's going to have a written speech, which is different than when he just stands up before a microphone,
right,
and says and walks into a pile of murd somewhere. Yeah, that's the problem.
Yeah, there are certain people who ought to have, every third sentence of the teleprompter ought to be stick to the prompter.
Yes, take a break. Terry?
I was just going to say, Joe is Joe. Joe is never going to be elected on his speaking abilities. He never has been elected on his speaking abilities. And he's very consistent. He's not an actor. He doesn't try to act. He's always himself. So I don't see him ever – I don't know that he has a history of ever trying to be anything that he's not. We know who Joe is, and he's been very good about sharing his life story with us. The key is what is in the speech, as Alan said. The speech has got to detail what he plans to do moving forward in the future, and that has to be his message moving forward. I think what we're going to start seeing moving forward is that Joe Biden will be the one delivering the message of what we're going to do moving forward to improve the situation for everyone, and – Senator Harris is going to be the attack dog that's going to go after Trump every day.
Jen Smith?
Yeah, I think what Terry just said is really interesting. And I think it'll be interesting to compare what was said in Senator Harris's speech last night and what will be said in Biden's speech tonight. Are they issuing consistent messages? Do they seem like they're in the same field? Are they clearly defining who they are and who, what roles they'll have? Because I think that's something they've been questioning. They'll say when you elect Biden, you're really electing Harris. And so he's got to stand on his own. But he also has to say that, show that he's ready to change the administration and who will be the other members of his leadership. That's something he also has been questioned about in recent weeks of, what will a true Biden administration look like? And I think that's something we'll be looking out for.
And obviously there's plenty of time for that, but you still have to wonder, just because the convention has been, this convention, we've been talking about how difficult it is to work within these confines of it being a virtual convention. Terry, you talked about this of public speaking. When you're not speaking to the public, you're speaking to them, but you're doing it through the lens of a camera. I'm curious as to what how the Republicans and the GOP are looking at this and planning for their own convention, and what kind of contrasts we'll see in that.
Yeah, I'm curious about that too, because this audience being removed so that there's no audience reaction, I feel as if it is going to be much more problematic for the Republican message. They need that audience to say rah rah to all of the attacks they make on various cultures and various groups and various ideas. And without that audience doing that, it's much, much more difficult. So I'm curious to see how they're going to format this.
It's going to be hokey. That's what it's going to be. And they are going to try to bring whatever entertainment values the president saw, on his television days, to this convention. They're thinking that way. I am sure of it. And I have a feeling.
Well,
please go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I am sort of curious because we've been talking a lot about production value this morning, and that is the one. I wonder if Trump will micromanage the production of this. We do know he is as much as some of us hate to admit it, really good at TV. In that, you know, he's had reality shows. He knows how to control a situation and how to, you know, create messaging and steer people in one direction or another. So I think it will be really interesting to see how the DNC will compare to what the GOP and the Republican National Convention will hold. I'm also leery and wondering, will it jump the shark? Will things just be too reality TV for a political convention? It's anyone's guess.
Linda?
Okay, well, as someone who has actually been at conventions since 1976, covering them, and as someone who has been speaking to a very large audience who did, I don't anymore, I'm retired, for close to 50 years through a teleprompter without seeing the audience, and has given speeches to large crowds over the years, I can tell you that my feeling is that last night, the better parts of the evening were the parts that were taped.
Mm.
The packages they put together were excellent. The weakest speeches of the evening were, in fact, those that were live. Pelosi and Hillary, and they rushed the speeches. They tried to put too many words in too short a time. It didn't come off as well as the produced pieces. And as far as Trump's talking about The Apprentice, Trump did not produce that show. He is not a producer, and he is not, I don't believe, Jen, as capable of controlling production as you seem to think. He is great, as you all have pointed out, with a crowd and rabble-rousing. How he's going to be in a more controlled situation is going to be interesting to watch, very interesting to watch, but none of this is going to be pretty. I just want to point out that it was only yesterday that Amazon took down, after a great deal of pressure to make them do so, the T-shirts and the caps saying Joe and the Ho, that Rush, because that's what Rush Limbaugh calls Kamala Harris, the Ho, Joe and the Ho. And it took Amazon several days to figure out that they probably shouldn't be marketing that.
Wow.
Don't in any way think this is going to be pretty. There are some very smart people in the Republican Party who will be producing that show, their infomercial, okay? And it may well be done well. Let us remember that the best ads, at least the best ads I have seen all year, have been produced by Republicans. I'm talking about the Lincoln Project.
Yeah.
They have people who know what they're doing. The question is, can they control Trump?
Linda, he's 10 points behind. He's 10 points behind in most of the national polls. Not CNN, but the others, and the average 10, 11 points. What does he do in order to use his time effectively to make up for whatever it is that has put him 10 points behind? Does he throw more red meat to the to his base, which isn't enough in order to win? What does he do? How are they going to use it?
I don't know. You know, Alan, I was going to ask you that, because does he stand firmly
I'm glad
on
I asked
the side
first.
And says white people stand here, or does he try to see this? Do they produce a show that says we're inclusive too? You know, here's our token black person, here's our token Hispanic, Latinx person. I don't know. Which way do you think they'll go?
Well,
I think they'll go.
Oh, sorry.
Way.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, we talked about this briefly yesterday, but I mean, I don't know. Not many details have come out about this convention. The one detail that has come out is two of the speakers are going to be the couple who pulled the guns on the Black Lives Matter protesters in their house and were arrested, and they're going to be have a speaking slot. I mean, that gives you some indication, right, of where we're going. And to Linda's point of this isn't going to be pretty.
And
well,
and the
you know,
other
it's
one
all
was
in the eyes of the beholder.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry.
But the question I raised with all of you, and I'm sticking to it, Linda was turned it back on me, is what would you do if you were Trump and you were 10 or 11 points behind and you had these several days in order to make up some distance? Would you, as you've just indicated, reappeal to all of those people and say we got to get, you know, we got to deal with the crime problem? What would you do?
Well, the Trump playbook has always been double down on what you've done before, right?
Right.
I don't see that changing.
But he's 11 points.
Oh, and what he did what it's going to be is the big lie. Over and over and over. Yesterday, he tweeted yesterday about, you know, again, how, what a wonderful president I've been, and didn't I build you a wonderful wall? No. But that's the big lie. You say it often enough, people.
No, he is. I believe
they're going to go that way. Stick with the big lie. Double down.
That's good. And as you know, I've said many times, he is a big liar. But you bring new purpose to the term, Linda, because it is the big lie. It is 1984 and the rest. He will just continue to say the most outrageous things, and there will be 33% to 40% of the people who believe it.
And yet, the obvious question is, yeah, if that's what you've got and you need to broaden in order to win, you need more than that base.
But hasn't he always needed that?
Are you bringing in more than that base?
But hasn't he always needed
it? Yeah,
Linda, I'm sorry for interrupting, but hasn't he always needed that? Hasn't that always been the problem? That from the first day, instead of...
The Republican Party always needs Democrats to vote for them because there simply are more Democrats than Republicans. They have always needed that. In his case, it seems to me that he just keeps, you know, flinging meat to the same tigers.
I couldn't agree more, and I am still scratching my head.
I'm thinking, is it just that he won't listen to anyone? That's a possibility, of course.
Terry?
He's got to think it's a winning strategy, and that's what you and I don't understand.
Terry, Jen, and then break. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I was just looking at the numbers on 538, and as of 2 hours ago, the president's numbers are just awful. They're just in a place where it is hard to imagine what he can say, what he can do to rebuild the ground that he's lost, especially with today we have more unemployment numbers coming out. We see that more people have filed for unemployment. Numbers have gone up. And, of course, the coronavirus continues to be a threat to our health and safety. So I think the environment that they choose to do this broadcast in for the convention will be very interesting. I suspect you're going to see him use the White House and the Rose Garden and probably populate it with lots of his base out there wearing red mega hats, which is going to be unprecedented and very alarming. But I think we're going to see that.
Jen, we're going to go to a break, but I'll give you the last word here before we do.
Yeah. I just wanted to go back to something that Linda had said about what was effective in terms of clips. And you know, we saw the ones last night. I loved the Estela Juarez letter to Trump about deportation, and it contrasted her words with Trump's clips. And I'm wondering if we're going to see any more of that tonight, or if we're going to see more of that during the Republican convention, and how that will get minced up, and how that'll affect what people are seeing, because people really gravitate to those styles of videos, and I'm scared. I'm curious. I'm questioning how those will play a role in how people ultimately vote.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We have a lot of letters, so I'll get to as many of those as I can before the top of the hour. We'll continue with our wonderful panel, Alan Chartok, Linda Ellerbe, Jen Smith, and Terry Gibson. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We've been talking about night three of the Democratic National Convention. Night four is tonight, and of course, we'll be carrying it live here on WAMC beginning at 9 o'clock. We do have a lot of letters, so I want to get to those, as I mentioned, right before the top of the hour. Kathy writes to us and says the best message Biden could offer, in my opinion, is where the present administration has sought to destroy our democratic institutions, we will restore and build on them. Public education, public health, universal voting rights, climate justice, dot, dot, dot. We also got this from Sherry, who says, for me, Kamala Harris occupied the space with strength and poise. I got a clear sense that she knows who she is and is not a person to back down or be intimidated. The impression was conveyed by her physical comfort and poise at the podium in that cavernous space. She also showed joy from time to time. I was very impressed and proud. Also, Tim says, interesting that Linda assumes that Kamala was somehow controlled by others to appear a certain way. What is with the assumption that she did not elect to depict herself in a certain way? That seems very dismissive of her.
May I answer that?
Of course.
I don't mean to be dismissive of her. First of all, no politician speaking at a convention sits there, writes their speech by themselves, doesn't listen to others, doesn't listen to the parties, to their parties. That has nothing to do with the fact that she's a woman. And I did not mean to give the impression that I do not support her and that I do not think she's darn good. But over and over and over, we have heard it said that, okay, she'll be the bulldog to go after Trump. Where was the bulldog? And what are we waiting for? Turn her loose. Let her do that. And this is not dismissive of her. I don't mean it that way at all. And she was up against enormous challenges last night with that silly stadium. You ask, how do you make a speech to an empty audience that's to a teleprompter? And the secret is intimacy. What you all have talked about, you get through by being quiet and intimate. You don't put somebody at a podium in an empty hall and do it. You sit there in a room, a classroom, at your home, or as Obama did, that you don't emphasize the separation of her. You emphasize her personally and let her get intimate and let her loose. If she's going to be the bulldog, let her go.
Good point. We also go to
Joe, if I may, yes. If I may just interrupt for a moment and say that the news media is reporting that Steve Bannon has been indicted for basically stealing Build the Wall money and keeping it for himself, that people were asked to give. I think it's important for people to know that.
Yes. Just breaking a
few moments
ago.
Of course I send him my thoughts and prayers.
We know you do.
In his time of trouble.
Yeah. Federal prosecutors have charged Steve Bannon and three others with fraud in the border wall fundraising campaign. And a story just breaking a few moments ago. We'll have more on it. I'll bring it up here after the break when we have a few more details from the actual indictment as to what were the charges. We also, let's go to Leslie, who says, until recently, the GOP convention was going to be with audiences, so I doubt they will be ready to put out a well-choreographed and interesting virtual convention like the Democrats. I agree with what Linda is saying. We also go to, Tim, who writes, interesting. Oh, okay, we got to that one. Eric says a big thing I took away from the speech is the language, and she came off as sincere, compassionate, and genuine. This is about Kamala Harris's speech. Her body language was, when talking about her family, could not be faked, pure love. Also, did anyone notice, asks Daniel, how Harris outlined the types of prosecutions she headed and ended with the statement, I know a predator when I see one, and then paused, looking at the camera for a two count. You think she was directly referring to the sexual predator in chief? Well, yes, I do. Right? We do think that.
One hopes.
Bob says, the panelist is spot on, but it will take many years before a majority of men will treat women anything more than real or potential property. Having a conscience doesn't mean you act on your principles. Kathy writes and says, Linda, I disagree. Kamala was powerful not because she was soft and sweet. Really? Predator is sweet? Nope. She was powerful because she chose powerful words, and she didn't need a lot of drama and screaming and yelling to make the meaning of those words be powerful. I'm sorry I disagree. Don't force her to be somebody she isn't. Don't deny her ability to be powerful in her own skin. Linda.
I'm not forcing her to be. I want her to not be someone she isn't. And I, once again, I want to reemphasize, I did not think it was a bad speech. I welled up with tears several times last night during what I was watching. Watching a succession of women, watching the visual of seeing that many women, my God, as a woman, look, black people know what I'm talking about. When you see someone that looks like yourself up there, it is thrilling, and I thought that she was good, but I thought she could have been better. And when you talk about she didn't have to yell or shout, look, I have heard great speeches. I was there when Mario Cuomo spoke. I was there in that hall. He didn't shout and yell. I just simply said it was an historic occasion last night. The speech itself was not historic.
I stand by that. Yes. We go to Amy, who says, I think in general that the Democrats have been hitting the tone perfectly right for this period of desperation in the country. For the most part, it's been a ton of sympathy, not slugging aggressively at Donald Trump. Also, a letter about polling. Hi, panel. Alan said that Trump is behind by 10 points. That is what the latest polls, 11 and some, but correct. Is that electoral points or popular points? Which is more important? Well, we know the answer to that, right?
Well, you got to get elected.
Right, exactly.
There's no question. I thought, by the way, Joe, for whatever it's worth, that the Obama line in which he said that Trump can't change, won't change because he can't, was the most damning thing that I have heard in days and weeks and months. It was a beautiful line.
We have about a minute and a half before we have to go over. I just want to give you a little bit more than what we know about the Steve Bannon arrest. Steve Bannon, President Trump's former top campaign aide, was charged on Thursday in New York with fraud for his role in a scheme related to We Build the Wall, an online fundraising effort that collected more than $25 million, according to officials. Mr. Bannon and three other defendants, quote, defrauded hundreds of thousands of donors, capitalizing on their interest in funding a border wall to raise millions of dollars under the false pretense that all of that money would be spent on construction. That, according to the acting U.S. attorney in Manhattan, Audrey Strauss. So much more to come on that story. Yes, Alan.
And I got a lot to say, but basically it's interesting. Some of Trump's friends get pardoned and some of his political enemies get indicted.
And people who believe in hate, people who want to build that wall, are surprised that the chief one is a crook. Really? What's surprising?
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Ray Graff is next with news. We'll go there right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And we have a great panel with us. Alan Chartok, Linda Ellerbe, Terry Gibson, Jen Smith, and we welcome your phone. We welcome your letters. We don't welcome your phone calls. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. Alan, you said you wanted to talk a little bit more about Steve Bannon, and we'll talk about that. If you're just joining us, you heard Ray talk about it at the top. But Steve Bannon, President Trump's ex-political advisor, has been charged in connection to the online fundraising campaign, We Build a Wall. $25 million is the apparently the price tag of the money that was collected in that effort, and three others charged as well.
Well, no, I just made the observation, Joe, for whatever it's worth, that Trump's political friends get pardoned. People like Roger Stone and others, and people he's had trouble with over books, they get indicted. And who by? Remember how strong the Southern District was, Fui-Parara, his successors, and then Trump moved in and swept them all out, and now the obedient sit there. So I think there's more to come on this story.
Joe, I just want to point out that in the story, what stands out to me as being very interesting to see how, and we'll see how Trump responds to it, is that this actually is all coming out of the United States Postal Inspection Office. So the United States Postal Service has an inspection arm. They're the ones that apparently have been working behind the scenes to put this all together and have discovered it and done the investigation. So just as we have a president who's trying to shut down the Postal Service, now we have the Postal Service actually working behind the scenes to indict one of his cronies.
But a former crony, not a present crony.
Well, I thought he was still in with him, wasn't he?
We'll see. How long would it take Donald Trump to say, I've never heard of Steve Bannon before. Who is that?
Yeah, right. I think I met him once. I didn't know him well. I thought they were still buddies.
Wasn't there a book issue between them, or am I confusing that?
No.
Well, maybe I am wrong.
I don't know that you're...
That so seldom happens.
I thought that there was still a comeback of sorts. This is from the Guardian, that he was fired in 2017. But that he is returning to the White House as an advisor. He has worked to boost insurgent conservative candidates in Republican primaries, something sometimes contrary to the Trump administration's aims. But now Bannon, a former Trump communications advisor, is working with the White House and said that he wanted to work on the forthcoming elections.
Pretty unclear and pretty uneven in terms of his history. The important word I would use to justify my maybe ill-informed opinion is fired. He was fired by them.
Yeah. But it was also a lot of pressure to do that, too. And I know. But, you know, there have been a lot of people that he fired and then they brought back. So that have come under fire and then have returned.
Well, with Bannon, it seems to be a day-to-day thing.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that it's interesting to see where this all will go and what he'll say about it. I'm monitoring the tweets, but nothing so far. I'm sure we'll pass it on when we hear more. Linda, anything on it?
A continuing string of consequences to, quote, only the best people that he would bring into office. How many indictments is this now?
Yeah, I've lost
one
track.
Just wonders.
Yes.
And it's more than indictments. It's going to jail.
Tweet on that, by the way. He lists them all.
Who did?
Under the heading of only the finest people, which is what Trump promised the nation.
Who did that?
Trump, you remember, at the very beginning said, I'll get only the finest people.
Oh, no, I thought you said that there was a list of the...
Julian Castro has tweeted to this story and listed every single one of only the finest people who have been indicted now.
Well, we will find out more, and we will talk about that as more details come in. Let's go to another topic, which is, of course, what Terry just referenced, and that is the post office. So there was the uproar over the post office, and then Louis DeJoy, who is the embattled postmaster general, said that he was going to halt a series of cost-cutting measures, including the removal of machines that sort mail, and that he did not want to avoid his line, quote, he wanted to avoid even the appearance of any impact on the presidential race. Now, congressional Democrats and election watchdogs are voicing new suspicions about the USPS. fearing its decision to suspend major changes to mail processing and delivery still stopped short of what was necessary to protect voters who intend to cast their 2020 ballots. Confusion persists. It's unclear whether Americans actually would receive their ballots on time and if they'd be able to return them easily, nor was it clear whether DeJoy would promptly restore the sorting machines he had ordered removed from some postal facilities nationwide, or if the changes he has made across the agency under the watch of President Trump would introduce delays into one of the most consequential elections in U.S. history. The uncertainty and distrust only embolden lawmakers on Capitol Hill as they prepare to grill DeJoy and Robert Duncan, the chairman of the Board of Governors that oversees the USPS, at a series of hearings to begin on Friday. Alan.
There's no DeJoy in Mudville tonight. No.
I like that.
No. No, in fact, we know what they were up to. We have no good reason to think that they're not still up to it. We know that Trump thinks if people vote by mail, it's going to be bad news for him, and therefore he wants to put a stop to it. We know that in states where he thinks he can win, he encourages it. You know, he is what he is, and that is duplicitous to a absolute fault. So do we think that this reason and suspicion that they're trying to kill the post office? We know it because Trump has said it. So most Americans, it turns out, really like to get the mail every day, and except for Sundays, and they are ticked off about this. And their polling is picking it up, and that's why DeJoy moves away from his position. I'm sure there have been calls from the White House, too.
Wouldn't
Well, I think that what's going on is, I think Alan is right, but I think the other reason they've pulled back is I think the damage has already been done. And their refusal to restore, or saying they don't have time to restore what's been done, but we won't do it anymore. That's too little, too late.
Right.
It is. It's simply too little, too late. On the other hand, I need to tell you that last night, at the very beginning, do you remember that Kamala came on at the very beginning? And she said, if you're worried about your vote and how it will be counted and if it will be counted, and she gave a text number and said, text the message vote. I did that right at that time, okay? And I followed it through, and I was able to. I live in Massachusetts, okay? And just by following the prompts after doing that text, I was able to discover that my primary, September 1st primary vote had already been received and counted. I was told four different ways that I could vote in the election, dropping my ballot off, how to make sure my vote was counted by mail. There was useful information there. Now, the downside is the minute you go on, you enter the text, they're going to ask you to enter your email, and you're going to get a lot of requests for money from campaigns. But I'm getting that already all day anyway.
Sure.
There was good information, though, of how to check and back up and make sure you're voting and that it's being counted.
Yes, a lot of people working on many different sides on this. Terry.
Well, I think all Americans and Congress and anyone in any decision-making capacity would be well advised to not believe anything that comes out of DeJoy's mouth. I think these are all just words that are meant to distract and make it look like action. Look, we know that Donald Trump, as Alan always says, is a lying liar liar. We also know that he surrounds himself with people that lie. And if you look at the record of his staff, the only people that are able to stay full-time employed with him are people that are willing to lie like he lies. Anybody who has any glimpse of honesty is eventually asked to leave. So DeJoy, for all likelihood, is a liar too. So I just think that it's very dangerous to believe anything that's coming out from that person's mouth right now. I think that the damage has been done, and I think more damage will continue to be done unless we hear from people inside the post office that tell us what's going on.
And, I mean, obviously those reports are coming out. The post office has many people are saying what is happening and on-the-ground reports. To Linda's earlier point of too little, too late, of how much damage has been done. And I wonder, I don't know, you know, how much do you actually find out, but will these hearings help in any meaningful way as to getting to the bottom of what's going on?
Well, I think they will.
Sure.
I mean, you know, you're going to have these guys up there sweating, and they're going to be asked some very tough questions and some pointed questions, and the investigators on the congressional staff will have asked those questions, and of course the Republicans doing their fealty, the Republican representatives who are not in control of that committee will do their thing. But yeah, it'll raise a lot of questions in a lot of people's minds.
Wouldn't it?
It will also, it has already had some effect already, because Trump came as actually called out Mitch McConnell yesterday for scheduling hearings close to his, Trump's convention.
I just love it.
I'm sorry, but it's fun when they start to turn on one another.
Maybe he'll fire McConnell's wife just to get even.
Look, if you're talking about a fight, a downright fight between Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump, I know where my money would go.
Okay, I'll buy it. Where?
McConnell.
Really?
Donald Trump has the masses, but he doesn't have the information. He does not know how the Congress works. He does not know how government works. And if you're talking about double dealing and stalling and how to do things, McConnell has years of experience at this.
Well, that's true, Linda, but there's another way to look at it, which is he doesn't really care about the Congress right now. I mean, he's a would-be autocrat who wants to do his own thing, and McConnell has too much at stake here. McConnell's problem is he's going to lose his majority, and he knows it. And that's why there seems to be a bit of a fight between Trump and McConnell, because McConnell is turning his people on Trump and has said so.
That's right. Which plays to the point I said, McConnell is a whole lot smarter than Trump. No less evil, but smarter.
No fight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see what develops. I'm amused by Linda's glee and the turning on each other. It is fun, I must say. It's rather fun to watch.
I never said I was a nice person, and I'm not running for Miss Congeniality.
Oh, but you are a nice person. We
yes,
know
you
that.
Are.
Okay, let's move on and talk about other stuff. I'm going to pick up this story. It'll give us an opportunity to talk about the larger story, which is, of course, kids going back to school. And there is a larger story there, but we will look to New York City, where teachers are threatening to strike over school reopenings. The union representing New York City's public school teachers said its members would not return to classrooms next month unless the city met their health and safety demands, including testing all students and staff for that coronavirus and ensuring that all schools have a nurse. The announcement from the United Federation of Teachers, which represents 75,000 professionals, comes a week after Mayor Bill de Blasio announced that schools would reopen September 10th for in-person classes, saying he believed the city's low positivity rate would allow for students to return safely. The city, once the nation's epicenter of the pandemic, has a positive test rate of less than 0.25%, the mayor said Wednesday. The president of UFT, Michael Mulgrew, threatened legal action against the city and said teachers would strike if the mayor tried to force them to return to the classrooms. He acknowledged that it would be virtually impossible for the city to meet the union's health and safety demands before September 10th, making a showdown between teachers and the mayor increasingly likely. This comes as schools across this nation are either just starting or getting ready to start classes, either remotely or in person. And these debates are raging all across the United States of America. Also, we should mention, as they are on college campuses, where in many cases, large groups of students have come back to campus and are now being told to go home after a matter of only days. So, Alan, we'll begin with you.
I always just try to put myself in the other guy's place, or the other person's place, because there certainly are a lot of people of both sexes involved in this. And that is, what would I say? Why don't you go in? to the classroom and teach, and then come back and see your children and your grandchildren and your parents and infect them, I would say, I don't want to go. And that's what's happening right now. I don't want to go. I think it's not unreasonable for people to say that. And I think de Blasio, who's one of the most unpopular politicians in America right now, has got himself a hell of a job to do here as he tries to get these schools reopened. But, of course, how does he get a city going, right, if he doesn't open the schools and give basic daycare to so many of those children, and you can't open the city and you can't get the jobs populated if you don't do that.
And I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but he's right on the fact that the numbers are low. And so at what point are we, barring a vaccine, do we start this process of bringing students back if we buy what we've been buying all along, is that there is a gradual approach to this of opening things up, and where does this fall in the mix?
We've got it low for a reason,
right?
We've got it low because we've been very, very cautious about what we're doing. You know, New York is not exactly an island. Manhattan maybe, but the city is not an island. And, you know, I get what the teachers are saying.
Linda.
Well, I also get what the teachers are saying. And I also, because I follow the news, let's go back and let's look at what the history has been here. Okay, the virus came. We were told it was nothing. Then we were told quarantine, it is something. Okay, the states that didn't do that or that were late doing that, and then they were told in May, okay, let's reopen, everything's fine. Science said don't reopen, medical experts said don't reopen. We reopened, what happened? More people got sick. Okay, you get in crowded spaces, people get sick. We reopen the universities, what happened? Kids partied, they got sick. What do you think's going to happen when we reopen the schools? People are going to get sick. Teachers and children are going to get sick. This is an enormous gamble. I understand the needs of children for schools and the needs, but it's not going to do them any good if they're dead or their parents or grandparents are dead. I'm tired of using people as the canaries in the coal mine, and now we've moved to using our children and our teachers as the canaries in the coal mine. How many times do we have to be told that this virus spreads very easily? How easy do you think it is to keep children apart? It's hard. It's very hard. It's almost impossible. It just seems to me that we keep practicing the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result.
That's a great point. Terry, what do you think?
Well, you know, a strike by teachers in New York State, a strike by public employees in New York State is incredibly rare, and that's because there is a unique law on the books in New York State that makes it illegal for public employees to strike. So, I mean, you see teachers striking more often in other states quite often, even recently. But it doesn't happen here because of this law. It's called the Taylor Law. So if they should actually follow through on doing this, they would be breaking the law, and they would find themselves in court. And I don't know how that is all going to pan out. I also think that there's a chance that they could maybe strike by school district based on how each school is dealing with this. So it might not have to be a statewide strike. But to Linda's point, you know, this is a very difficult situation. You really cannot expect teachers to go in there and risk their lives in situations that are clearly going to be unsafe. And many of these schools that teachers go to work in are ancient. They may not even have air conditioning. They may not have windows that can open. They're just not up to the standards that we would expect in the 21st century, as most of our infrastructure is not. So it all points back to just the lack of leadership at the top that has created this chaos, and only new leadership will get us out of it.
talk about the leadership, though, even in the state of New York. Alan, what do you make of the governor's somewhat hands-off approach here of saying it's up to the students, or it's up to the parents, it's up to the teachers, and it's up to the schools to come to an agreement? I mean, that is
Passing the buck.
Well, it is passing the buck, and it's also assuming that those three sides can get along and come to some mutual agreement, which does not seem to be the case in most school districts across.
And remember, Joe, that those people are not one. Those aren't three sides. Within each side,
right? Exactly. Yes, you have this. Differences. Yes, absolutely.
And as far as Cuomo is concerned, you know, he's very smart. If it's too contentious, he says, you guys go decide and report back to me. And that's what's happening in so many areas, including the police and the other stuff that we're talking about now. So, I know how I feel about it. On the other hand, I have to tell you, my son lives in New Orleans. His son is going to school, and he tells me that he wears a mask all day long, that he washes his hands every 10 minutes, and he's under strict instructions to do that. Scares the hell out of me.
Mm. Well, I brought this up yesterday. I mean, at what point, and well, even this morning, of what point do we start trusting, Terry, that the things that are in place, that all of the planning that the schools have done and various institutions have done are going to work and to keep us safe? Because there is trust that comes in that.
Yeah, there is. I mean, we've learned to deal with things like the flu and other viruses that we've learned to manipulate around. But this one is different because we're just still so much we don't know. And it only takes one person that decides to defy all those rules for even a short period of time to infect other people. And the next thing you know, you have an outbreak on it. And, you know, you're talking about trying to control an environment where you have, you know, it's children, even on a college campus. I mean, I was on a college campus yesterday preparing for my upcoming semester. And, you know, there were certainly students that were abiding by the rules, and there were those that were obviously not. And, you know, I'm thinking back to when I was in college at that age, and would I be able to abide by these rules? I don't know. It's very challenging. You know,
it is hard. I got to take a break, Terry, but I'll pause you there. But we'll be right back. I promise. We'll continue our conversation. Last go round with our wonderful panel. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue after news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and our wonderful panel this morning made up of Alan Chartok, Terry Gibson, Jen Smith, and Linda Ellerby. And we have been talking about all kinds of subjects this morning. We have a couple of letters that I want to get to so that we can move on to other topics. We go to John, who says our social services personnel have worked throughout the pandemic, amongst many others, in healthcare, police, and fire departments. They deserve our continued respect. However, I am ambivalent to our teachers' concern. Public education demands sacrifice from all. So basically, is that, am I right in saying that if the healthcare workers, the policemen, if the police officers and the fire departments do this, then teachers should too? Is that what I'm taking from that?
Yes, that's what the letter is suggesting.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So what do we make of that argument?
Okay, I'll just say this.
I love when you start with a deep sigh. Go ahead.
Elizabeth Warren started last night by making the point that childcare is part of the infrastructure of this country and should be treated as such, funded as such, and looked at as such. Now, she meant childcare and not just school teachers, but that is part of it. Maybe if they were treated that way, respected that way, and paid that way, maybe it would be their jobs to throw their lives on the lines. But they're not healthcare workers. They're teachers. And we don't consider childcare part of the infrastructure. And we don't respect teachers, and we don't respect childcare. and we don't fund it accordingly. So I'm not asking a teacher to lay down their life for a kid, for my kid.
Terry.
Of course, I don't have kids.
Right.
At this age.
At that age.
Yeah,
at school age.
I think Linda, you know, hit it spot on. I mean, you know, the teachers risk their lives already as it is. I mean, the shooting incidences that have happened in schools and college campuses over the last decades, you know, have required all types of safety measures to put in place. I mean, I work in a classroom that has magnetic locks on it in case that should happen. So there are already many risks that are being taken. And, to equate a policeman or a firefighter to a teacher, I think is not really fair. You know, we're treated very differently. And I think Linda said it perfectly. You know, if we were paid the same and treated the same and given the same resources, it might be different, but that's not the case.
All right, back to the mailbox here and other folks weighing in on this subject. A report out today has found that asymptomatic children can have a higher viral load than even symptomatic adults. Teachers are right to be scared. What does it say about, and we're seeing, you bring up a very good point, Terry and Alan, too, of talking about teachers striking and the law against it here in New York State. But so what are teachers to do, and teachers who don't perhaps have the same union backing that they do in New York City?
Well, there comes a point,
they try to form a union.
Yeah.
Well, there comes a point at which one examines their lives and they say, is my life worth more than the potential for going to jail or forming a union or doing all of those things? Listen, that's the history of America. You know, people have done that. So I'm thinking that, if it's my life I'm talking about, you know, I'm pretty sure what I would do.
Linda?
You all have already said it. We have seen teachers throw their bodies between children they teach and shooters in schools. And we have seen teachers be asked to learn and teach children all of these safety techniques. And we have seen teachers be faced with the idea that they should be armed. What else do we need to put on teachers? How much more should we put on them before we pay them more, respect them more, and stop this nonsense?
Just for the...
There are things teachers shouldn't have to do, and this is one of them. They shouldn't have to risk their lives. And I'm with Alan. If I were the teacher, I know the decision that I would make. If I were the parent, now I have a son who lives in London, has three sons. I have a daughter who lives in Portland, Oregon, has a daughter. My daughter is keeping her daughter home from school. My son in London is sending his three boys to school. I'm fairly clear on the arguments and the various things here. And it is a horrible decision for all concerned. But it's not something that we can simply say, well, this will all work out fine if the teachers just get out there and do what they're supposed to do and take care of our kids, because we discovered that without school, it's hard work.
Mm.
Aw, really?
I normally, of course, would go to Jen Smith, who is an education reporter for the Berkshire Eagle. She was called away by her editor at the Eagle for a story that she's working on. Thought she could be back and unfortunately is unable to come back with us. I just heard from her. So we thank her very much for being on the program. And so I was waiting a little bit to go back to her. But unfortunately, we'll catch up on her thoughts at another time. So we move on to another story, and probably the last of the day, and that is just an overall, it's been a little while since we have talked about the numbers when it comes to coronavirus. We're talking about school and talking about the virus in that sense, but just what this country has gone through. At least 169,000 people have died from coronavirus in the United States. I'm using numbers from the Washington Post. These numbers are coming from Johns Hopkins. 169,000 people have died from coronavirus in the U.S. At least 5,499,000 cases have been reported. This all since February. The average daily death toll has declined from more than 2,000 per day to 456 per day in early June. But as people began to resume more normal activities, new COVID cases soared and deaths soon followed. By August, the virus was killing an average of more than 1,000 people each day. Health officials anticipated the rise in deaths because the disease had been accelerating through populous Sunbelt states such as Texas, Florida, California for weeks in July and August. Hotspots also sprung up in the Midwest and even in the less populous states such as Alaska and Hawaii. The governor of Ohio, Mike DeWine, says we have to assume that the monster is everywhere. So new daily reported cases fell 19.7% in the past week. Deaths fell 7.7%, and COVID-related hospitalizations fell 22.3%. Among reported tests, the positivity rate was 6.3%, and the number of tests reported rose 7.5%. But obviously, when you look at the map and where there are problems, you still look to the south. You still see Florida. You still see Georgia, Louisiana, Alabama, and other states that are taking the brunt of this, Kentucky as well. And many, many cases coming in. I'm looking at this. Also, Mississippi and Tennessee. So just some numbers that we haven't really talked about as far as where we are right now. We think of it as most recently spiking. It is going down a little bit. But if we've learned anything, is that there is an ebb and flow to this, and we can't take anything for granted. To what all of you were just talking about, it does seem that by going back to school, whether it be college or K through 12, you're still going to see problems and you're going to see those numbers elevate. The question is whether it will be significant or minor, as most municipalities hope is the case. Alan.
We don't have a cure. We don't have a vaccine yet. We're going to have a vaccine, and I suspect we're going to have a cure. So the question is, how impatient are we? Can we wait it out? Can we wait to the point where we say, well, now it makes great sense for people to go back because we have a vaccine. The teachers can get the vaccine. The students can, except for the people, the anti-vaxxers, and I'll reserve my remarks for them later. We've just got to have a little patience and forbearance to let this thing get resolved before we put people's lives at risk. End of discussion.
Terry?
I agree. I just think that patience is not a trait that all Americans share. And I think as young college students, as high school seniors, you know, these are groups that are at a point in their lives where they're not likely to be as patient as those who might be older and more experienced. So I just think once we see schools coming back together and have students in classrooms at the college level and the public school level, that you are going to see numbers rise. It seems to be inevitable. I think the key is, do we have the financial resources in place to allow for the testing and the tracking that we know helps mitigate the damage? And so far, we're not really seeing that.
Linda.
Well, we're not even see people going out and raising money to get N95 masks and the other PPE equipment that we got for healthcare workers. Why aren't we doing that for teachers if we want them to go back to work?
Mm-hmm.
This just makes no sense. Same actions going to bring same results. I've said it before. I don't have nothing else to add to this.
The numbers, there are obviously some people have said that we'll hit 200,000 by the time that fall hits. There are obviously concerns about the flu season. We talked earlier this week about what medical professionals are calling a twindemic of both the flu and COVID working hand in hand, and the difficulties in dealing with both, and the calls by medical professionals to also for many people to go out and get their flu shot as early as possible. In the 3 minutes we have left, I'd like to just go to the remaining letters that I have in front of me. John says, dear panel, some people don't want to hear this. You said, absent a vaccine, we flatten the curve by staying home. Any attempts to open schools or businesses is fundamentally flawed. There will be no safe way to open until we have a vaccinated population or herd immunity. John says, your point is good, and teachers already are at risk every day, but it's the children that should not be at risk. They come first. I notice that you occasionally make comments that teachers are underpaid. You probably don't know any New York teachers. I think that $100,000 per year plus good benefits for 180 days work is pretty good. Thanks for all the great work. I'll let you handle one, Alan.
Here we go again. Our teachers are the most important people in America. There's no question about it. You know, I got really beaten up one time when I came on during a fund drive and I said, hey, you know, who's more important, a doctor or a teacher? You know, teachers are fundamental to the way in which our kids develop and whether they become human beings of importance. And, you know, there's nothing like a professional teacher. And if they're getting $100,000, good. And they deserve more.
Phil writes and says, if school opens, teachers are not the only ones at risk. All the kids, all the staff, and everyone, all of them come in contact with, will be at risk. This is the ultimate super spreader. And then we go to Tracy, who talks about the USPS. It took 5 weeks before I received new registration and plates for a vehicle my father gave to me. I thought it was a DMV problem, but no, DMV processed my paperwork and sent my envelope the same day I put the forms in the Dropbox. From Schoharie to Albany to Cobleskill. 5 weeks, .. And we're hearing many stories like that, anecdotal stories. About things that should have come from one town to another in a relatively short period of time and taking much longer. So we thank you all for being here. Alan, thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks, Chief.
And thanks to Linda Ellerby and to Terry Gibson. Thank you both. I appreciate it. And also thanks to Jen Smith, who had to run, but we thank her as well.
As we say, she got called away.
That's right. She got called away. And we will continue with the Congressional Corner right after this break.